have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover today, so let's dive in, starting with local and Metro. Some changes are in store.
On the way. Yeah, the Transportation Committee of the King County Council this week voted to change the way service is allocated on Metro transit routes. The old rule was often called the 40-40-20 rule, was set up by the members of the King County Council as a way to appease the rural the members of the rural and suburban council, the ones that represent the rural and suburban areas of King County. And what it did was it allocated 40% of new service to the south part of the county, 40% to the east side, and 20% and only 20% of all new service to the Seattle routes, which unfortunately are also the most heavily traveled. But when cuts came, cuts were spread out evenly over the whole system, depending upon hours of service on the different routes. So when cuts came this last year and Metro cut 75,000 hours of bus service, 60% of those cuts went to the city of Seattle, even though it had only been getting 20% of new service over the past several years. Now, the new rule, this came as a recommendation to the council by a committee that did a study for them. The new rule, service levels are going to be based on the number of households and jobs in a given area, with an emphasis on serving lower income areas. So they'll be looking also at income levels for different neighborhoods. And they'll also be looking at places that would be natural hubs for quote-unquote growth, meaning, you know, places where there are lots of jobs and lots of shopping. So, for example, the Microsoft campus will be allocated a certain level of service, or, for example, Northgate, just so you have some idea of how they're going to allocate service. So that's a positive change, but I'll be interested to see if that really means there are going to be cuts to the South King County and East Side, and if there's really going to be growth on some of the in-city routes that are having some of the worst problems with leaving people at the stops because the buses are full, or problems where, you know, you get on a bus and it's so packed that it's almost a dangerous situation for riders. Of course, now this vote is also going to have to be taken by the full council. Once it's passed by the Transportation Committee, then the council has to vote on it, hopefully sometime in the next couple of weeks. But it also doesn't necessarily mean increased service for the entire, for many routes on Metro, because bus service may have to be cut across the entire county in the next 2 years unless a proposed $20 car tab fee for transit funding is passed by the council. A supermajority of the council would have to, six out of nine members would have to vote for the $20 car tab fee, but it looks like at least four council members, four of the conservative rural suburban council members, will not vote for that. Yet a simple majority could send that to voters in November, and I'm guessing that in November we're going to see an initiative on the ballot for a $20 car tab fee to fund Metro. Without that, Metro will have to cut at least 200,000 hours of bus service over the next 2 years.
All right. Well, on to state employment report out this week.
Yeah, this week the state's employment report showed that, and this was kind of funny because the Seattle Times, once again, our good friend, the Seattle Times, had an article entitled "State's Job Data Sends Confusing Signals About Recovery."
Some of us aren't that confused.
Yeah, I read that and I'm like, okay, that assumes a lot of things. First of all, it assumes that we're in a recovery. And secondly, it assumes that the job data is confusing, which it is not. It's only confusing if you're deeply out of touch with what's going on, or if you're completely clueless, or if you are, as many Seattle Times editors are, too well paid to know what's going on
if you're just really, really, really invested in the idea that there's a recovery going on.
Yeah, exactly. And so let's just kind of look at it for a second. The figures in May show that the state lost 700 jobs overall. The private sector lost 900 jobs while government added about 200. In the various industries they saw growth in, and this is what the article said they were most confused about, is where the growth was and where the losses were. The industries that showed growth were leisure and hospitality, which of course means you're talking about the rich and tourists, professional and business services, which means all those big corporations that have been doing so well in the quote-unquote recovery, construction, which is not surprising given that the apartment market is starting to heat up for all those people who are being kicked out of their homes and need a place to live, and government with a few hundred jobs, which you could reason is the tail end of last year's federal stimulus taking effect. And then the industries that saw a fall in jobs were wholesale trade, retail trade, financial services, transportation, warehousing and utilities, and education and health services, and manufacturing. So literally the biggest part of the economy, which relies on consumer spending. All of that relates to falling consumer spending and failing small businesses. These are all things that...
Well, in the case of education, government spending too.
Yeah, and a certain amount of local government spending, state and local government spending, government jobs that showed an increase would relate to federal stimulus spending, but education, health services, you know, all of that stuff would relate to state and local government having to pare down their payroll. And so, you know, it's no mystery why we had this kind of jobs data and why the quote-unquote recovery is coming to, a halt. Also this week, the National Federation of Independent Businesses released a study showing that more small businesses are planning to fire workers than are planning to hire new people, while it is exactly the opposite for major national and multinational corporations. Small businesses, I want to point out, employ about 50% of the workforce in this country, and that the single biggest problem for these small companies that they cited in this economy is poor sales or lack of consumers coming in and spending their money. So, I mean, none of this data is a surprise, and it's not confusing unless, of course, you are so heavily indoctrinated that we are in a recovery.
Mm. All right. Moving on. Governor Gregoire signing a bill this week, 5942?
Yeah, Senate Bill 5942 that would allow the state to look at bids for privatizing the liquor distribution system here in the state of Washington. This is something that that voters looked at the polls last year and by a wide margin voted it down. The legislature, however, looked at a bunch of different proposals for privatizing liquor, and in particular, when they were looking at the state of the budget, they looked at different ways to make additional money out of the system of liquor sales and distributions in the state of Washington, and they decided that we should have the option to privatize distribution in order to get a big one-time upfront payment from a private liquor distribution company, and that could help us plug the hole in the budget over the next biennium. Unfortunately, the study that was done to look at, well, over the long term, would that bring in more money, showed that over the long term, it would be detrimental to the state's coffers, that they would bring in less money if they privatized the system. Nevertheless, Gregoire, who had the option to veto that part of the bill, decided to sign the bill completely into law so that now the state has the ability to potentially privatize liquor distribution for a one-time lump sum payment that could help the budget for the next year or two, but that could ultimately hurt the tax coffers. And I think that she really fell down on the job.
So if the legislature and Gregoire are so adamant about ignoring the will of the voters, how come Iman's initiatives seem to be so sacrosanct?
That's a good question.
Just wondering.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, Jav, you spoke last week about Governor Gregoire not making clear on what her plans were for the future, and this week it appears that she did.
Yeah, she did go ahead and decide to quote-unquote retire which obviously she's not going to retire. She's either going to go into the Obama administration or she's going to go join a law firm or something somewhere, or a lobbying shop, or both. But she decided not to run for a third term as governor, and Representative Jay Inslee immediately announced that he would the next day that he would in fact be running for governor. Now Inslee and Attorney General Rob McKenna on the Republican side are widely considered to be the front runners for governor in 2012. But there was another wrinkle that was thrown in this week also, which is former King County Executive Ron Sims, who has been serving in the Housing and Urban Development Department for the Obama administration for the last couple of years, abruptly resigned from his job there and is coming back to Seattle. There was some immediate speculation that he might also be looking at running for governor next year. But in point of fact, a lot of the speculation in local political circles now is that he's actually looking at running for Seattle mayor against Mike McGinn and presumably Tim Burgess in 2013. Now, this, if true, and mind you, at this point, it's simply speculation, but given that our good friends at the Seattle Times and some of the people who tell them what to do from the downtown establishment have been pumping Tim Burgess for mayor since approximately 2 to 3 minutes after Mike McGinn was elected in 2009, they may have to rethink that at this point, but it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. One way or another, Ron Sims almost certainly is going to be looking at some sort of executive job. It's unlikely he'd be looking at a congressional job since he's never really had a legislative job in the past. I don't think so. Was he ever on county council? I don't remember.
I think he was.
Yeah. It was a long time ago if he was. But in any event, it'll be interesting to see how that speculation plays out. But at this point, the biggest question is whether either Inslee or McKenna are going to have any primary opposition. Dave Reichert's name has been mentioned on the Republican side. There have been some names on the Democratic side as well. So we'll see what comes of that.
All right. Moving on, our two senators are voting this week on troop reductions?
Yeah, over two dozen Democratic senators this week, not voting. They signed a letter to the Obama administration calling for sizable and sustained troop reductions from Afghanistan. Now, remember, July of 2011, that's next month, was the original date when Obama did his escalation of the Afghan war in 2009. That was the original date by which Obama was pledged to start reducing troops. Yeah. Now that started sliding, and now it's summer of 2014 and counting. But particularly with the death of Osama bin Laden and the rather poor progress that's being made, and I'll talk more about that in a little bit, in the Afghan war, there's more and more pressure in Congress now from both Democrats and some Republicans to try and bring the Afghan war to a close. This is the latest step in that, and this included both of Washington's Democratic senators.
Yeah, now that it's safe for them to take that stand, they don't actually have to do a real congressional vote on it. Now it's okay for them to sign a letter calling for withdrawal.
Well, it can still be used in ads against them, but it won't be.
But it won't be, yeah. Not as if they had taken a real vote on it.
All right. Moving on then to national and the FBI updating one of their manuals.
Yeah, the FBI says that it is revising its manual for domestic surveillance in order to expand agents' individual powers. Now, the name of the manual is Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide for folks who never realized that the FBI actually had a guide to govern these kinds of things. It is mostly a declassified document, so people should be able to see what is in it. There are portions of it, however, that are secret, which I find very interesting. The new guide supposedly will allow the agents to investigate you without needing to show probable cause of criminal or terrorist activity. In other words, anyone can now be subject to an FBI investigation, whereas before there were different levels of investigations that they could do, and they had to have some probable cause.
Yeah. It's not even probable cause. The actual wording is that is firm evidence. So even if they don't have any firm evidence of wrongdoing,
that's for one level of investigation. There are different levels of investigation. The lowest level, they needed probable cause. They don't even need that anymore. the lowest level has been broadened so much that they don't need any kind of even suspicion that you may be engaging in criminal activity or terrorist activity. Now
What was the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution again? Something about search and seizure?
Yeah, something about unreasonable search and seizure. Agents also don't need probable cause to search your trash or administer a lie detector test. All they need is to say that they were considering recruiting you as an informant. Also, quote, what they call quote-unquote surveillance squads can be used repeatedly on anyone at any time without any kind of probable cause. In the past, you needed to have at least an assessment opened on you, which is the lowest level of investigation. In other words, they needed some reasonable cause to send a surveillance squad after you, and they could only do it once unless they opened a formal investigation. Then they could repeatedly send surveillance squads. Now they can use them on anyone at any time and repeatedly. An agent or informant can attend up to 5 meetings of a targeted group before they have to follow a set of rules. And that set of rules is part of the manual that is top secret and that nobody without a security clearance can read.
And now, mind you, it was the previous regime that enabled the FBI to go and harass all of these various nonviolent activist
but
groups.
But the previous regime said that an agent or informant could attend 1 meeting before they had to follow the top secret rules. Now they can attend up to 5. That's the change. And protections in the manual exist for what they call media and academics. But the way they define media is limited to legitimate members of news media. There's no definition of what a legitimate member of a news media is. And prominent,
Fox News.
Yeah, and prominent bloggers. Non-prominent bloggers are not members of news media, although they don't define what that is either. And academics, however, are defined as only those who work for institutions based in the U.S. So if you have a visiting professor from France, for example, he is subject to all of the rules in the domestic investigations and operations guide, and probably also the CIA would be looking at him as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
So does that explain actually your earlier item about the 200 additional government jobs in Washington State last month?
I bet it does.
All right. Let's move on to other national security news this week. President Obama. And use of national security letters.
Oh, yeah. The Libertarian Cato Institute, there was a story that got a lot of attention this week, which I'll talk a little bit about, where Middle East blogger Juan Cole, it was revealed that the Bush administration had tried to use the CIA to collect information on Cole, but very little attention at the same time given to a study put out by the Cato Institute that the Obama administration has been abusing national security privileges even more than the Bush administration was. You remember back in 2005 when there was a lot of brouhaha around the FBI's use of national security letters under the Patriot Act, whereby national security letters could be used to collect information on targeted suspects without those suspects even knowing, financial records, bank records, academic records, medical records, and so forth. Well, in the worst of the years in which the Bush administration were abusing those, and literally they were used for dozens of people previously, some 9,475 national security letters were issued in 2005. Well, according to the Cato Institute, the Obama administration in 2009 spiked that number to 14,788, and then in 2010, last year, to 24,287.
Wow.
So, and on some 15,000 individuals.
Incredible.
So, a remarkable increase in the number of these secret letters that are being used in order to collect information on people who, as we just heard, may or may not actually be suspected of anything.
All right, moving on. Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah, the Supreme Court ruled that no one can be held accountable when an investment fund commits securities fraud. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled that if a fund manager writes a fraudulent statement that's made to the SEC or to the public,
even if it's knowingly fraudulent,
even if he's knowingly fraudulent, he's not liable. Only the fund is. And, of course, most investment funds are LLCs. LLC stands for Limited Liability Company. Now, are you getting the picture here? They also ruled, and this is a decision that it was a 5-4 decision with most of the conservative justices carrying the majority, that even advisors like lawyers and accountants, et cetera, to these LLCs are also not liable because it's just advice that they're giving, which is, I think, just an incredibly irresponsible ruling. Now, the justices who agreed with that ruling, Clarence Thomas wrote the argument for the majority. I think
which tells you a lot right there.
Which tells you a whole lot, yeah, right there. Clarence Thomas, who was widely viewed as probably the worst Supreme Court justice in history. The other justices who agreed with him are John Roberts, Antonin Scalia, Anthony Kennedy, and Samuel Alito. And the justices who disagreed and strongly disagreed include Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Stephen Breyer, who wrote the minority decision on that case.
All right. Moving on, the National Assessment of Educational Progress.
Yeah, we got the results of the latest National Assessment of Educational Progress, which gives tests to fourth graders, eighth graders, and 12th graders. I found the results for the 12th graders particularly disturbing. It tests their competency in 8 subjects: math, science, reading, writing, civics, geography, history, and economics. Can you guess which subject they did the best in? It was economics. 42% of high school students were proficient in economics. Their worst subject was history. Only 12% of high school seniors were proficient in history. So when you look at that, you think, okay, this is exactly the kind of citizen that our society wants to turn out, that our government and our business leaders want to turn out. People who understand economics and are rah-rah for the capitalist system, but whose knowledge of history is scant and disturbingly deficient.
You know, any kind of history that might undermine the narrative of rah-rah economics.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, so it's rah-rah economics as opposed to, you know, real economics.
Real economics,
which,
yeah.
We actually could have them go to D.C. to help out. All right, moving on. House Republicans putting some pressure on.
Yeah, the War Powers Resolution Act came due for the war in Libya this past week, because the War Powers Resolution requires congressional approval if you have been in foreign hostilities for 60 or more days, and it's been 60 days now since the Obama administration joined into the effort to help the rebels in Libya. The Obama administration making kind of a disturbing argument. Now, mind you, every White House since the War Powers Act, and I believe it was 1970, every White House, Republican and Democrat, has resisted actually asking Congress for permission to wage war. And I think pretty much every, with very few exceptions, every administration has actually waged war as well. The Obama administration did not argue that the War Power Resolution Act was unconstitutional, did not argue that Congress had already approved it under the War on Terror. What they argued was that they weren't really at war, which is
preposterous.
Preposterous. Thank you. That's a very good word for it. So, yeah. So in this case, even though the Republicans in the House are being enormously hypocritical, because they didn't certainly have any objection when the Bush administration abused the entire process of going to war, they happen to be right in this case. The Obama administration also is abusing that process.
Yeah, and this is the Obama White House going against the advice of lawyers from the Pentagon and the Department of Justice, who advised Obama, saying that there was no way he could argue that U.S. involvement in the assault on Libya is not engaging in hostilities. We're providing ammunition, weapons, and intelligence. We are helping to preserve the no-fly zone by disabling anti-aircraft guns. We're even sending unmanned aerial drones to drop missiles. And the standard that the Obama administration is using because we don't have troops on the ground, we're not in hostilities. Well, every single war, as Jobs said, every single war since World War II, we have used massive air campaign in order to lead off hostilities. You can't say that we're not in hostilities in Libya.
All right, moving on, Afghanistan.
Yeah, Gareth Porter, who we heard on Counterspin a half hour ago, had a report this week that analyzing General Petraeus's statistics last year in 2010, where there was a huge media narrative over much of the year that the U.S. forces were making progress against the Taliban because of the number of Taliban that had been captured. Well, it turns out some 90% of those alleged Taliban were in fact civilians. In fact, they were released within 14 days because of military rules that require an assessment and for those people to be released if there is no evidence that they have any relationship at all to the Taliban. So what was happening was Petraeus's forces and some of these special forces were just casting nets, picking up people more or less at random, holding them for up to 2 weeks, and then releasing them and calling them captured Taliban, and the U.S. media went for that narrative.
All right. And Iraq?
Yeah, New York Times report this week, very valuable, saying that even though only one of 11 Iraqi drilling contracts went to a U.S. company when those were auctioned off 2 years ago, that the Russian company Lukoil and many of the other international oil companies that did get those contracts are now subcontracting mostly with four large American oil services companies, all of which are headquartered in Texas: Halliburton, Weatherford International, Baker Hughes, and Schumberger. Once again, the state of Texas did very well in the Iraq war, and the rest of their country, not so much.
All right. And Japan.
Yeah, some new news about the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. Al Jazeera ran a news article this week called "Fukushima, It's Much Worse Than You Think," where they interviewed a man named Arnold Gunderson, a former nuclear industry senior vice president, and he talked to them at length about how bad the radiation leaks were. He reminded them that their equivalent of 20 nuclear cores have been exposed there because of the large amount of fuel rods stored in storage tanks that were exposed to the air during the accident. That the meltdown in number 1, 2, and 3 reactors also included a melt through in at least one reactor, which means radiation is still escaping into the environment. That the use of water means, of course, that the plants are still, they're still releasing steam into the air, which means leaks. And that Japan is finding hot spots further away from Fukushima than the Russians found with Chernobyl, with levels at radiation levels that caused the Russians to evacuate people and declare those areas no man's land. Japan is not doing that with their hot spots. The reactors are still releasing cesium, strontium, and plutonium isotopes, what he called hot particles. Scientists are finding those hot particles all over Japan, even in Tokyo. And he reminded us that hot particles don't necessarily get picked up on Geiger counters because they're so dilute. But a hot particle, if it's picked up and inhaled or ingested by a human being, it causes irritation in the body and is a source of cancer. Your body does not get rid of those hot particles. Those particles also often get picked up in car filters. Radioactive air filters from automobiles are becoming common in Japan, and we are even finding some of them in Seattle as well. So that was a very interesting article, and I recommend it to people.
Yeah, there was also an item in that article that 8 West Coast U.S. cities, including
Seattle.
Oh, no,
this is a different article. This was run in Counterpunch. 8 cities on the West Coast: Seattle, Portland, Boise, San Francisco, San Jose, Santa Cruz, Sacramento, and Berkeley. They looked at the statistics for infant mortality in the 10 weeks after the Fukushima accident. There was a 35% increase in infant mortality. Now, the numbers are small, but that's statistically significant. They looked at the 4 weeks before and the 10 weeks after, and they found that week per week, a 35% increase immediately after the accident at Fukushima. I just want to remind people that radiation effects are cumulative over time, that these numbers need to be continued to be looked at, and there should be better measurement of radiation in people here on the West Coast. Gunderson reminded us in Al Jazeera that the West Coast, particularly the Northwest Coast of the United States, is getting the brunt of the windfall from the Fukushima plant, so that the U.S. government should be doing more to look at health effects from that.
Events.
Yeah, this weekend, in fact, coming up at noon today, is the Fremont Solstice Parade, and the fair runs all weekend. On Tuesday, June the 21st, at Pigott Auditorium at Seattle University, Joanna Macy and Chris Jordan, $20 for adults, $12 for students up to age 25. And then Thursday, June 23rd, the Seattle Foundation is doing something called a Give Big Day, involving a number of nonprofits and social service agencies around Seattle, where they are matching donations to all those various nonprofits and agencies on that day. So if you want to give to your favorite nonprofit on that day, that that donation will be matched. More information about that at seattlefoundation.org.
And again, that's June 23rd.
Yes.
Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. That's where they find Eat the State.